Welcome to another episode of the Oncology on the Go podcast. I'm your host, Russ Conroy. As part of a Cancer Network Frontline Forum program, experts reviewed updates in the management of EGFR exon 20 non-small cell lung cancer and how these findings may apply to clinical practice. Dr. Alexander Spira of Virginia Cancer Specialist Research Institute and Dr. Millie Das of Stanford Health led one part of the discussion in this patient population. They spoke about the evolution of molecular profiling and next-generation sequencing in the management of this disease, as well as clinical and non-clinical factors informing treatment decision-making in the second-line setting. They also reviewed data from the Phase 1 Chrysalis trial assessing amivantamab as a treatment for patients with disease progression following chemotherapy.
So let's talk today, Millie, about how many patients you typically see in your practice with advanced non-small cell lung cancer who have an EGFR exon 20 mutation. Do you think they have a different disease biology? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so I mean, I think, we know that EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations really represent a minority of patients with EGFR mutations. So about 10% of patients with EGFR mutations are going to have this rare variant, this exon 20 insertion. So I don't see as many. I don't think, those of us who are thoracic medical oncologists only see and treat lung cancer patients. Certainly we've seen these patients, but they're certainly not at the same frequency as patients who have sensitizing EGFR mutations. So I do have, I would say about a half a dozen patients with this specific EGFR exon 20 mutation. And in my experience that these mutations tend to occur in the same type of patients that are going to have EGFR sensitizing mutations. So we do more frequently see them in younger patients and never smoking patients and frequently also in patients of Asian ethnicity. So it does seem to be a similar patient demographic and pretty similar disease biology as well. As far as EGFR sensitized mutations, I think we see brain mets more commonly in these patients as well as we do with the EGFR sensitizing mutations.
Yeah, and I think you said it very well. And I think the interesting point is talking about the numbers of patients. So, even if you're like the busiest thoracic oncologist ever, and if you saw 150 new patients a year, you're still only going to see 1 to 5 of these a year at most. So when we were doing some of the clinical studies, I felt like I became the expert. But now that these drugs are commercially available, great for our patients. But obviously, there'll be a lot of one-offs for a lot of folks as well. How do you test for the exon 20 mutations? Which modalities and methodologies are you using?
I think many of us are now using next generation sequencing or NGS to detect these alterations, including EGFR exon 20. Back before, when we were doing piecemeal testing, for EGFR, that was just through PCR testing. But I think most of us are now have switched over to NGS. And so we're seeing these results being reported on the NGS panels.
Same here. I think, you're trying to get it all done with one test. And I think during our ASCO, when we were talking, we talked a lot about blood-based assays as well. And I think a lot of us are doing that as well. And I don't think we need to belabor this right now. I guess the ultimate question is, what do you think about the prognosis of this versus EGFR wild type or EGFR mutations? I think, it's obviously hard and things have probably changed a little bit with the advent of these new drugs, but what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, I think the fact that these patients, the EGFR exon 20 mutant patients do not respond well to the EGFR TKIs, namely osimertinib, which is what we're using frontline in our patients with EGFR sensitizing mutations. When we don't have that option for these EGFR exon 20 mutation positive patients, they're getting chemotherapy up front. And generally just because of that fact, these patients aren't going to do as well as patients with EGFR sensitizing mutations, who can get osimertinib, frontline. And so the prognosis does tend to be worse for these EGFR exon 20, patients compared to the EGFR sensitizing, positive patients. So, it's just important to keep in mind.
Yeah, I agree completely.
So Alex, I kind of wanted to ask you, how has molecular profiling and NGS evolved in the treatment of non-small cell lung cancer, particularly with exon 20 mutations?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And I would like to say it hasn't evolved and that we were doing full NGS panels for the last 5 or 6 years on everybody, but we know that's not the case. So I think with the advent of every new drug approval, we're doing more and more. You know, we were part of this big community consortium, US Oncology. They published their data with this MyLung. And even a year or two ago, we were still probably only hitting 70 to 75% of patients being tested, which you would really want to see that number be 100, right? I mean, the breast cancer world has got it down to 100, but we still struggle to do that. But I do think every day more and more patients are being tested with every new targeted therapy. And I think it's really evolved over time to the fact that we're doing this. And I also think it's very important, you know, before you talked about NGS, you know, NGS, I think, is the gold standard because you may miss some with some PCR. And I know there's some hospitals using some very old PCR technologies. So I really do think NGS is the way to go. Plus, let's face it, you're getting tested for everything. You should just be getting tested for everything rather than doing the piecemeal studies.
Exactly. Yeah, I think things have evolved in that direction. And how does the presence of an EGFR exon 20 mutation influence treatment selection in non-small cell lung cancer?
So I'm a still by the book kind of a person. So I think for me, outside of a clinical trial, and the first answer on NCCN guidelines is find a clinical trial. We all know that. But for me, I'm giving people chemotherapy. I'm still, you know, not giving immunotherapy. I'm extrapolating from the other EGFR inhibitors that we know that immunotherapy does not work, but I'm giving everybody chemotherapy who can enroll in a clinical study, and then thinking about either amivantamab or mobocertinib as second line treatment. How about you?
Yeah, I agree with you as well. I tend to offer these patients chemotherapy up front and tend to avoid immunotherapy.
And I think we talked a lot before about the selection of the different medicines, so we won't go in there. So lots of things to talk about right now. So, you know, we talked about what treatments do we recommend. I just mentioned mobocertinib and amivantamab. I know you nodded yes to that, so I know we're talking about the same thing. Are you always waiting for mutation testing results to begin first-line treatment?
Yeah, I think whenever possible, I do wait. And what's nice is that a lot of, you know, the NGS platforms now have a pretty quick turnaround time. And at my institutions, we do perform reflexive testing through the pathology department. So the hope is that you'll have those results in hand by the time you're seeing the patient. If not, then, you know, if you're having to order it, it may take additional time. But I think whenever possible, I do want to have those results back to help inform my frontline treatment decisions. Sometimes we don't have the luxury of time. Sometimes these patients are admitted, they need to get started on treatment urgently. And in those cases, while we're waiting for the testing results, we'll go ahead and get started on IV chemo. But I think whenever possible, we do want to wait for these results, just for the main reason of being able to offer a patient treatment with a targeted drug if they have a targetable mutation.
Yeah. You know, one thing I find very hard is, you know, we talk about targeted, you know, the patient comes in, let's suppose you don't have the NGS results back. You know, I give my little speech. I'm sure yours is similar, but different. I say there are three treatments. There's chemo, there's immuno, there's targeted. I explain to them targeted, and then come back in a week, the results are back. And then you say, well, you have a targeted therapy, but we're not going to use it right now because we're going to save it as second line. So that's always a challenge. And I'm sure other people are having the same conversation. Do you use off-label treatments? Do you use osimertinib? I think when we had our group discussion, we talked about high-dose osimertinib. Are you using that routinely? Are you using immunotherapy at all?
I'm not. No, I'm currently not using these off-label or unapproved treatments.
Yeah, no, I think we're all on the same page with that one. And what do you think about the results of, you know, how do you compare osimertinib for regular EGFR mutation with amivantamab and mobocertinib for the exon 20s? Do you think there are different response rates? Do you have any thoughts there? I mean, obviously, this is a very broad question, right? But how do you compare it? Do you tell people they're any different?
Yeah, I think for the two FDA-approved options for our EGFR exon 20 insertion patients, so amivantamab and mobocertinib, they're both approved in the second line, as you mentioned. And the response rates are lower than what we see with, let's say, osimertinib in an EGFR sensitizing patient, where, you know, response rate 70-80% in that setting. In the exon 20 insertion patients, when we're thinking about amivantamab, response rate on the order of about 40%. With mobocertinib, it's a little bit lower, on the order of you know, 27%. And so, you know, when we, so there's a big difference in efficacy there, response rate, which is why, you know, osimertinib is used in the frontline setting and amivantamab and mobocertinib are reserved for patients who've progressed after frontline therapy.
Yeah, no, I agree completely with that sentiment.
So Alex, what percentage of patients with metastatic non-small cell lung cancer and an EGFR exon 20 insertion have disease progression on or after frontline therapy?
Unfortunately, they're all going to progress, right? I mean, I think if you wait long enough, that's going to happen. And I do find things a little bit different. I think about things a little bit different for this than I do of other therapies. You know, for example, you know, we've all had scans. There's that little bit of growth. Maybe you can do something here. But I really have a very low threshold to put people on targeted therapy if they've gotten chemotherapy first, because I believe in targeted therapy. Again, probably not as good as the typical exon 19, exon 21 with EGFR inhibitors. But I, you know, when I start to see progression, I do try to put them on second line therapy with mobocertinib or amivantamab as soon as I can. I am monitoring these people pretty closely. I do get routine brain scans. You know, as you pointed out, Millie, that there is a lot of CNS progression here. So I do want to monitor that very closely. Obviously, the role of these drugs in metastatic disease to brain is yet to be determined very well, but I still look for that very closely so we can most importantly intervene with radiation as need be. I'm typically seeing it, you know, about a year to a year and a half into treatment. Obviously, every patient is different. Any different thoughts there?
No, I agree. And, you know, I think, you know, yes, these patients will progress after frontline therapy. And, you know, we all have sort of our own surveillance strategies. And you know, many of us are scanning patients every 2 to 3 months just to, you know, make sure that we catch that progression early. And as you said, you know, really intervene, you know, with second line therapies when we start seeing signs of progression. And so I guess to sort of another question related to that, what are the second line treatment options available after first line on after progression on first line? And we talked about amivantamab and mobocertinib, but what are the clinical and non-clinical factors that are helping us inform second line treatment decision-making, including patient factors such as age and performance status and comorbidities? And you know, how do we think about these options?
Yeah, no, so it's a great question. So for me, I'm looking at the patient, obviously seeing how they're doing. And, you know, we talked before at our group discussion, oral versus IV. I firmly believe in the side effects. I mean, obviously there's patients that have to come for 5 hours. That's one thing, but I firmly believe in managing patients based upon what I think their side effects are going to be. And for me, I lean more towards amivantamab because I think in general, the side effects are a little bit better tolerated. You know, you do have the pain of coming in for that, you know, very frequent IV infusion, 2 days to begin with, and then weekly for a while after that. But I do think that patients tolerate that a lot better than the side effects of, you know, the GI side effects that we talked previously about, diarrhea and those things. Clearly, patients have a preference, right? I mean, if they really want an oral drug, and you can't blame them if they want an oral drug, I'll certainly put them, give them that as well. And I guess so the ultimate question is, you know, what to do after you get amivantamab or mobocertinib. You know, it's interesting because I think NCCN guidelines actually have, you know, you can switch there, but there's not a lot of data. So have you done it? What are your thoughts about switching from one to another at that point? And what do you do?
Yeah, I think the thinking is they have different mechanisms of action. And so they could potentially be sequenced. And, you know, I have done it now in, I think, one or two patients where I've given them amivantamab first, and then they've had disease progression after time, and then I've switched into mobocertinib. In both cases, I actually had, I offered an intervening line of single agent chemotherapy, you know, before the mobocertinib. Really, there's no data behind that. But, you know, we also know that chemotherapy can be effective in patients, particularly with, you know, with EGFR exon 20. So I single agent docetaxel, single agent gemcitabine, are options. And, you know, I can't really say I have a lot of data to support the sequencing and hopefully we'll have some data that'll help inform that. But right now, I think it's, you know, everyone sort of has their preference on how they want to perform the sequencing. And I do also, like you, talk to the patients about the pros and cons of the different options available. The reason why I also try to offer IV chemo is just what's nice about, you know, if I'm using amivantanib for before mobocertinib, it's nice to have the pill option, the mobocertinib option. And for some of these patients at each time of disease progression, they may, you know, be developing more symptoms related to progression, more functional decline. And so it's nice to be able to have the oral option as sort of a backup is how I view it. And you know, sort of get the IV therapies, which may be just tougher and more burdensome for the patients, sort of out of the way. And so that's how I kind of think about it. But I do talk to the patients about the various options and see, but in my practical experience, I've seen that most patients are okay, you know, trying the IV therapies and then at some point, switching to the mobocertinib. And again, I don't have a lot of data to say that this is an effective sequencing strategy.
I really just wish somebody would actually do the darn the study, right? I mean, it shouldn't be that hard to do. You know, these big institutions do it all the time. You know, they had 15 patients treated, and, you know, that's enough to really see how things are working. So it'd be great to just get some anecdotal data because people are using it off-label. I guess briefly now, I'll talk a little bit about the results. I'll start by talking about amivantamab and the CHRYSALIS-1 study. So the CHRYSALIS-1 study was a very straightforward study. It started as a phase 1 open-label study for patients just getting amivantamab for patients who are exon 20 insertion positive after they got chemotherapy. Cut right to the chase, there was 81 patients on the study. The response rate by RECIST was 40% with 3 CRs. Progression-free survival was a little over 8 months. Most common side effects were rash, infusion-related reactions happened very commonly, as well as paronychia. Most people I thought did very well. And actually I thought the data was very impressive there. And that's the study that led to the approval of the drug. Do you want to talk briefly about mobocertinib?
Yeah, sure. So mobocertinib was evaluated in the EXCLAIM phase 1/2 study. So there was a specific cohort for EGFR exon 20 insertion patients. So these were patients who had received at least one prior line of therapy. They had to have good performance status, there were 114 patients enrolled in that cohort. Median age of patients was 59, 65% of these patients were female, 60% were Asian, and the primary endpoint was overall response rate, and the results for overall response rate was 28%, and this included one complete responder. Disease control rate was 78%. As far as treatment-related adverse events, 91% of patients, so large majority of the patients did experience diarrhea, and then this was followed by 45% of patients experiencing rash and 38% experiencing paronychia, mostly GI and skin side effects with this drug. Okay, so Alex, let's now talk about any notable differences in the efficacy and safety data that we just presented on these two drugs, amivantanib and mobocertinib.
Yeah, thanks, Millie. It's always hard to talk about this because we're doing cross-trial comparisons, and I think I used the analogy before. The first thing they think they teach you in medical oncology fellowship is don't do cross-trial comparisons. So I think, but in general, if you've given both of these drugs and based upon the study, there is more GI side effects with mobocertinib, diarrhea, nausea. Certainly, even if you just think about the biology, you know, you're taking a pill every day that's going to be chronic versus an IV drug that's given every so often. So that to me is the bigger side effects that are seen with that. Probably a little bit more mucositis with it as well. I do think a little bit more paronychia, that classical EGFR side effect seen back in my old days. I'll date myself with erlotinib, but also with cetuximab as well. You know, obviously efficacy is very tough. There were, you know, if you look at the raw numbers, amivantamab does appear to be a little bit more efficacious, but the numbers weren't dramatically different there. And obviously in small studies with a lot of different variables, tough to tell right now. So that's how I kind of view that. I guess, how do you manage some of these side effects? There's lots to talk about. Why don't you, you know, start with the rash and the GI toxicity?
Yeah. So, I mean, we have a lot of experience, thankfully, in emerging rash and dermatologic toxicities because of the EGFR TKIs that we were using previously. You mentioned erlotinib. So that was, you know, we were using erlotinib back in the day before osimertinib was approved, and higher incidence of rash and dermatologic toxicities with the earlier generation EGFR TKIs. So I think this isn't all that different. And so proactive management is critical. A lot of times we are referring these patients to dermatology to help co-manage. And that's been really helpful. I have some patients typically when I'm prescribing these drugs that I know are going to, you know, have a high potential for causing rash, I'll go ahead and prescribe a topical clindamycin lotion or ointment for the patients to apply to prevent superinfection. And there are some patients who are very, very worried about acne-like breakouts. And so those are patients that could be considered just for like oral antibiotics to prevent rash from occurring or to mitigate some of the skin side effects. So there are a lot of different ways. I think, you know, it's important to talk to patients about the potential for these toxicities, to talk about what can be done, and different patients are going to choose different things. And it's nice now that we have that experience, and our dermatology colleagues also have great experience in helping to helping us out when the, you know, it's kind of the first line of therapy that we can offer our patients maybe isn't as effective. And then they have great ideas for other things that can help to manage.
Do you want to talk briefly about some of the GI toxicity and, you know, especially those infusion reactions? I think is an important topic as well.
Yeah, the GI toxicity, you know, again, a lot of our drugs can cause diarrhea. And so, again, proactive management with Imodium after you use bowel movement, low threshold to switch to prescription antidiarrheals such as Lamotil or tincture of opium. And so, you know, again, we have a pretty good handle on how to manage that. And then in more severe cases, we may send patients to see our GI colleagues for additional interventions. And then as far as infusion reactions go, this is just important to know with the amivantanib in particular. These are patients that we absolutely want to be counseling the potential for infusion reactions and making sure our nursing colleagues are aware. The nurses are really great at managing infusion reactions. And again, we have experience from using other antibodies in the clinical setting, such as Rituxan or Cetuximab. It's pretty similar to those types of infusion reactions. So just alerting patients, letting them know to reach out to the nursing staff if they start feeling any signs or symptoms of an allergic reaction or infusion reaction, and then making sure that the nurses are comfortable with the pre-medications and the medications to give when a patient does develop the reaction, and then of course holding the therapy and reassuring patients also that it will resolve, and even though we may discontinue the treatment on day one, when they come back on day two, they can resume the treatment, and most all of the time patients will be able to continue on therapy, which is actually great.
Yeah, agree. I thought you said that very well. And I think that's important reminders for the physicians as well, especially if you're not used to it.
Yeah. So Alex, how would you say the treatment landscape of EGFR exon 20 insertion positive non-small cell lung cancer has evolved over time?
I mean, you know, I have to tell you a little story. So I remember when all this started a few years ago, and you know, we were doing a lot of PCR back then. Again, I'm dating myself. I remember when we started for the first patients on, and you knew about these drugs and you kind of knew about destruction. You knew it was involving, but we, you know, with PCR, not everybody was checking for exon 19 and 21. And then I said, oh, you're right. We don't really barely know about these. How many patients are there? And then it turned out there were more. We didn't have any drugs. And now we have two drugs. I mean, it's amazing, right? So we now have two drugs that are FDA approved. And of course, they're not perfect. Hey, I love it. I think it's great. And, you know, we have new options for these patients that I've never had before. So it's a great, great, great thing. So I guess now, you know, where do you think things are going to go? I mean, so, you know, let's talk a little bit how, you know, this has clearly changed the landscape in precision oncology, and it's really pushed things forward for drug development for these rare genomic entities. And I think it's opened up we'll continue to get new drugs for these rare entities. You know, lung cancer is now the 3-5% disease. You know, when I started, we had two drugs, carboplatin and paclitaxel. I think I said that before. Now we have drugs for, you know, 1-5% a drug gets approved for. It's amazing and great for our patients. I guess, what are your thoughts right now? What do you think the biggest unmet need is, and how do you think those things will be addressed?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is an exciting time to be a thoracic medical oncologist. I think the potential to find these mutations in our patients and to have drugs that target them is really exciting. And so I think as we move forward, I think the goal is to try to come up with better therapies for the mutations we're already seeing in our patients, and have other targeted therapies available at the time of disease progression, identifying other driver genetic alterations. So even though we've really made tremendous progress over the past decade or so, we are still a number of patients where we haven't been able to detect the driver alterations, or don't have a drug that targets that yet. And so I think that's the move, the way forward now is to continue to try to find the small percentages of patients who may harbor an actionable mutation, and to try to come up with drugs, and then realizing that unfortunately none of these drugs are real cures for our patients. And so there's always room to do better, and trying to come up with better drugs that are, you know, well tolerated with high response rates. I think there's always room for improvement.
Yeah, and we talked about some of the newer drugs being developed right now. And, you know, before these drugs even approved, we were making second generation drugs or third generation, whatever you want to call them. Maybe they have less side effects. Maybe they have better central nervous system penetration. It's great. And I think a lot of these are going to be addressed. And obviously, we'd love to get these drugs earlier on to patients. You know, I always remind people that only 50% of lung cancer patients get to second line therapy. Maybe it's a little bit more for the EGFR exon 20 insertion. We obviously don't know, but I think that's great. So I think this has been incredibly informative. Thank you, Dr. Das, for this very insightful discussion.
Thanks, Alex.
Next, Dr. Joshua Sabari of NYU Langone Health and Dr. Misako Nagasaka of the University of California, Irvine, also discussed updates in this patient population. They spoke about new potential treatment options, including mobocertinib, as well as potential next steps in research such as moving drugs to earlier lines of therapy, and better understanding mechanisms of acquired resistance to treatment.
So Dr. Nagasaka, let's begin. So tell me a little bit about next generation sequencing and the, you know, sort of revolution of targeted therapy in non-small cell lung cancer.
Sure. I think it's certainly an exciting time to be a thoracic oncologist. We have so many targets that are available, and it's become very important to try to find these targets. So at the time of advanced metastatic stage diagnosis, I do both tissue and liquid-based NGS to determine these alterations to see if I can find anything that I could target.
Yeah, it is impressive, and I completely agree. You know, thinking about seeing a new patient in the office, there are so many options of therapeutics that can benefit patients. I think one of the key things we get back, and curious in your practice, is the PD-L1 expression. And really, you know, we're sort of itching to use the PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitors based upon that. I think it's critical, obviously, to wait for the next generation sequencing, as you mentioned, which open up a whole other sort of array of therapeutics for our patients, particularly the targeted therapeutics. And how long does that take you to get back in your practice, Dr. Nagasaka?
So I send them out, and for the liquid, it takes about 7 to 10 days. And for tissue, it takes about 2 to 3 weeks. And it is certainly a little bit frustrating at times that not having these results back quick enough, but I still try to emphasize the importance of waiting for these and not just jumping on to the PD-L1 score, which you usually get back in like 3-5 days or even less. Just because I believe it's really important to make sure we connect the right treatment to the right patients.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. In our practice also, it takes us, you know, 2 to 3 weeks to get back tissue-based NGS, and we do an in-house panel that is not reflexive. We have to order it. So it's really 2 to 3 weeks from the time point that we order it. Dr. Nagasaka, you mentioned that you order, you know, NGS on all patients up front for identification of somatic alterations. Do you ever order NGS other times in patients' treatment paradigm?
Absolutely. So, for example, if I have a patient who comes to me for a second opinion, and maybe they have already been on first line or second line treatment, I always review whatever was done initially at the time of their advanced metastatic stage diagnosis. I look at the molecular testing report, but if I get a report that wasn't a comprehensive one, that didn't use NGS, I reorder it at that time because I really don't want to be missing anything. What about you, Josh?
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I'm using, you know, both plasma as well as DNA-based NGS up front. And as you mentioned, you know, some DNA-based assays could miss some alterations, particularly some of the fusions. And I sometimes do repeat, you know, in the second line setting. But clearly, when someone's on a targeted therapy, we want to understand acquired resistance. And we'll talk briefly about that when we mention some of the inhibitors down the road. And there, I find it very helpful to repeat testing. You know, first I use plasma and then usually following up with tissue-based NGS. Here's Dr. Nagasaka, in your practice, are you doing these together up front, tissue and plasma? And is it ever sufficient enough to just do plasma alone when you meet a new patient with stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer?
I think those are great questions. I tend to order them both at the same time. I think one could argue that you could save tissue for later or maybe for clinical trials if you get a positive result on the liquid biopsy, but a negative liquid biopsy does not rule out patient having possible targets. So in that case, even if the liquid is negative, I tend to wait for the tissue results.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I always mention going fishing, right? If you go fishing and don't catch a fish, you don't conclude that there is no fish in the ocean. Same with plasma NGS, right? With, you know, circulating tumor DNA. If you don't identify it in the plasma, it doesn't mean that it's not there. So, you know, false negative rates could be as high as 30, 40%. Really, you need to fall back on the tissue-based NGS. But if you identify it in the plasma, I couldn't agree more. I act upon it. So lots of barriers for testing in the frontline setting, you know, tissue acquisition, sufficient tissue. We mentioned turnaround time already. And we know in community practice, you know, broad panel NGS occurs at about only 50 to 60% of eligible patients. So what are some of the strategies that you can think of or recommend for improving testing rates for, you know, broad molecular biomarkers in non-small cell lung cancer?
I think education is key, both at the provider physician level, as well as patient level. I know that patients are very eager to get started on treatment, but knowing that they could have options based on their genomic mutations, that's really important. So I really think education is key here.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And then, you know, also education, education, education. But if we can remove this responsibility from a human, right, and have this done sort of reflexively, I think all patients would have NGS testing. Can you imagine, Dr. Nagasaka, a breast cancer patient,
just like
right?
Breast cancer, right?
Yeah, not having ER, PR, and HER2 status. Right. So I think we need to move to that sort of paradigm in non-small cell lung cancer. So
I agree.
Excellent discussion. And I think really doing broad panel NGS in all patients is critical up front, but more importantly, not just to order the test, but to wait for the result so that you can actually act upon it and provide patients with the best possible therapy in their, you know, line, in the frontline setting. So we know that, Dr. Nagasaka, that EGFR mutations are quite common. And, you know, so many different types of EGFR mutations. We hear about the activating mutations, exon 19 del and L858R, but then we hear of a lot of uncommon or more rare EGFR mutations. So walk us through how EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations fit within this space of EGFR mutations.
Sure. So up until recently, we didn't have inhibitors for EGFR exon 20s, and it's certainly an exciting time. As Dr. Sabari mentioned, EGFR mutations, the most common sensitizing ones are EGFR exon 19 deletion and L858R on exon 21. And those account for like 80-90% of all EGFR mutations. However, there is a small component of other EGFR mutations. And within the other EGFR mutations, there is EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. Sometimes people get confused with EGFR exon 20 T790M mutations, but totally different. T790M is a resistant mutation that occurs when one is treated with first or second generation EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitors. But what we're talking about, EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, is a de novo mutation that is not considered to be in the common sensitizing group. And until recently, so to be exact, AMI was approved in May 2021 and MOBIL was approved in September 2021. Until recently, we didn't have inhibitors directed against this particular group of EGFR mutations. So it's really become an important target to identify.
Dr. Nagasaka, how are you identifying this uncommon or rare EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant population in your practice?
Sure. So I send out both tissue and liquid, and I have gotten positive results for EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations in both tissue as well as in liquid. I think the most important thing here is that we use comprehensive testing or NGS because there are multiple variants. It's crazy. It's like every time I check, like it used to be like 50 plus variants, 60 plus variants, and I think now there's more like 100 plus variants for EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. And these you cannot check if you're not doing NGS. So that is why I use upfront NGS.
Yeah, and you make a really good point. Over 100 different EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, and they can occur in different locations, the helical region, the C helix, the loop, you know, so, and maybe some of these therapeutics have different response rates in different locations. It's possible. We're still studying that in clinical practice. But, you know, even for me, it's hard to keep track of all these different variants. So any difference in the variants? Are there some variants that may be more responsive to classical or standard EGFR inhibitors versus others?
So I think we're still learning that, to be honest with you. Data that has been published are mainly retrospective from the MD Anderson group, right? So we need a little bit more data there, but if we're not checking, we won't know. So I echo the importance of checking and checking broadly.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. A complex space, but understanding that EGFR exon 20 insertions make up a broad array of different alterations. And, you know, something that I also see commonly in practice is if you're not doing broad panel NGS and you're really focusing on more piecemeal testing, like imagine if you did IHC for exon 19 del or L858R, you would miss all exon 20 insertions. Or if you did a PCR-based assay looking for EGFR, you'd miss over half of the EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation. So I agree with you completely, Dr. Nagasaka. Thinking about the frontline setting, you need to do broad panel NGS in all patients. And I, too, use both a tissue-based assay as well as a liquid assay. And again, if the liquid is positive, you can act upon it. If negative or non-diagnostic, more importantly, falling back on your tissue-based NGS. So moving into the treatment, you say you identify a patient with newly diagnosed stage 4 non-small cell lung cancer harboring an EGFR exon 20 insertion mutation. What's your first line of therapy for this patient in your practice? Are you using a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor here? A lot of people in the community practice are still using the KEYNOTE-189 regimen in this patient population. Is it wrong to use pembrolizumab, for example, plus chemotherapy in this group of patients?
So I don't think it's wrong, but I don't think it's right either. I tend not to use immunotherapy. I tend to use platinum-based doublet chemotherapy in this space, just because I think we're still learning about the potential risks of treatment in this particular space, in the EGFR exon 20 insertion mutated space. I don't think there is much data with AMI, but if you're thinking about second line use of MOBO, I believe there was a publication or a poster or some presentation on the increased risk of adverse events when patients were given immunotherapy and were treated with MOBO for second line. I believe that adverse events were increased in general, and not, it wasn't just like immune related adverse events. So it's hard to make sense of that data. But as we're still learning in that space, and as there could be other tyrosine kinase inhibitor-like trials that I might be able to offer patients, I try to avoid the use of PD-1 inhibitors in this space.
Yeah, I agree. You know, it's an interesting population because, you know, upwards of 50% of patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations are former smokers or even active smokers for that matter. Whereas a patient who never smoked, you know, that patient population, I agree with you, really does not derive any benefit from immunotherapy. But your second point really hits home very closely because we always worry about subsequent therapy and potential toxicity with subsequent therapy, primarily post a PD-1 or PD-L1 inhibitor. And for that reason, I really try to keep immunotherapy, PD-1, PD-L1 checkpoint inhibitors in my back pocket. And I agree with you, Dr. Nagasaka. I'm using chemotherapy in the frontline setting, usually a platinum doublet with carboplatin and pemetrexed. Now, response rates we know are in that 30, maybe low 40% range, and PFS is about 6 to 7 months. So, you know, chemotherapy has a lot to be desired in the frontline setting. And unfortunately, chemotherapy does not cure patients, and all of our patients will unfortunately have progression in the frontline setting. So in a patient with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutant non-small cell lung cancer, who you've treated with frontline carboplatin and pemetrexed, who has progression, and we're not talking about oligometastatic progression that you can radiate or treat locally, I'm talking about widespread progression in multiple areas. What is your next line of therapy, or what are your next options for treatment in this setting?
Sure. So based on NCCN guidelines, the two options that you have are amivantamab and mobocertinib. One is IV and one is an oral. So I do bring up those options, as well as clinical trials for that matter, as options for patients. And then we have a discussion. I tend to prefer using amivantamab. I'm a little bit biased because I have the studies. I'm comfortable using it. I believe that perhaps the response rates are slightly better, but I think both are options.
Yeah, so let's dig into the data. I'll talk about amivantamab. I'll allow you to then talk about mobocertinib. And I really want to have a discussion about what factors do you sort of think about in your decision-making discussion with patients. I think Dr. Nagasaka and myself, we were both involved in the development of this agent very early on. And it was exciting to see the broad activity of amivantamab across all EGFR mutant patients, including the common mutations, exon 19-del and L858R, as well as the uncommon or more rare EGFR exon 20 insertions. And on the phase one dose escalation, we saw about a 30% response rate in patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations. And this led to a confirmatory cohort of expansion population, specifically in patients with EGFR exon 20 who had received frontline therapy with platinum doublet. So that was a large study, over 120 odd patients treated with amivantamab at the recommended phase two dose, which is 1,050 milligrams in patients weighing less than 80 kilograms and 1,400 milligrams in those patients weighing greater than or equal to 80 kilograms. And it's important to note that this is a therapy that's given somewhat uniquely, right? It's not an infusion once every 3 weeks, but it's a weekly infusion for the first five times, followed by bi-weekly. And we saw very early on an interesting infusion-related reaction. Curious, Dr. Nagasaka, have you seen, obviously, those infusion-related reactions?
And all the time.
Those? Yeah, what does all that look time. Like in your practice?
Right. So it depends. Some patients have chills, rigors, low-grade fever, chest discomfort, shortness of breath. It's all over the place. When you first see it, it's kind of scary. But at this time, all the nurses are like very well used to this.
And when are you seeing it? When does it occur in your patient population?
So it almost always occurs on the first infusion, if it were to occur. And the chances of it occurring again on the second day of the first week is like 1% or less. Uncommon to see it happen again.
Now, Dr. Nagasaka, there's another agent, mobocertinib, an EGFR and HER2 exon 20 TKI. Walk us through that data.
Sure. So mobocertinib, or MOBO for short, is a potent oral small molecule tyrosine kinase inhibitor that targets EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, and MOBO is structurally designed to gain selectivity by targeting proteins in the vicinity of the alpha C helix, a binding site not exploited by osimertinib. So the study that led to the approval of MOBO was called the EXCLAIM study, and it had several cohorts. The most important cohort, perhaps, is the PPP cohort, which is platinum pretreated patient cohort. And in that, they included 114 patients with EGFR exon 20 insertion mutations, and they received mobocertinib at 160 milligrams once daily. There was also the EXCLAIM cohort, which basically included 96 patients who were previously treated EGFR exon 20 insertion mutated positive non-small cell lung cancer patients. And initially, they presented their investigator-assessed objective response rate, which was 35% in the PPP, prior platinum pretreated patients, and 32% in the EXCLAIM cohort, so previously treated patients. But then the BIRC assessed, so blinded investigator reviewed committee assessed objective response rate was 28% for the PPP. Although the response rate was in the range of 28-35%, I think what the study showed was impressive waterfall plot with 84% of patients having a reduction from baseline in sum of target lesion diameters per IRC assessments. The other impressive data was the duration of response, which was at 17.5 months. But then the toxicity was an issue. So compared to amivantamab, where the toxicity was mainly the infusion-related reaction that you see for just cycle one, day one, mobocertinib had more EGFR-related toxicities, and the major one was diarrhea. So any grade diarrhea was 91%, and grade three or higher diarrhea was 21%.
Yeah, so it's interesting that we now have two therapies FDA approved for our patient population. Dr. Nagasaka, when you're sitting with a patient, are you going over both of these agents in practice, or are you just selecting one versus the other? And how do you make that decision with your patients?
So I do go over both of them with the patient, just because if I don't select the other, that would likely be the third line agent for the patient. So I do want them to understand what's coming up. So I do go over them in details with them. And I think it's really important that the patient understands the differences in the treatment, efficacy, as well as the toxicity profile. And also there could be sometimes consideration that needs to be made for patients who need assistance coming back and forth to the infusion area. Maybe like they don't want their loved ones taking time from work and driving them back and forth. Maybe they would rather take a pill. So I try to put those under in consideration as well.
Yeah, I agree. I have that same discussion. It's a shared decision-making because, you know, we have very early data from both of these agents. You know, like you mentioned earlier, I tend to prefer amivantamab given my experience with it, given that it's better tolerated in my experience. But there are patients who want oral therapies who might live very far from the cancer center. We're talking hundreds of miles away, who may need to be on an oral therapy. It's important that this oral therapy, mobocertinib, or MOBO for short, as you mentioned, is not a therapy that you want to start patients on and see in 3 months. It's a medicine that you want to see patients back in the office after 7 to 10 days, because you do need to manage the toxicities. You want to check electrolytes. You know, you want to think about, you know, sort of managing their diarrhea appropriately. So it's important, even though it's an oral therapy, which I know a lot of patients prefer, you know, thinking about monitoring toxicity is critical. So if I start it on a patient, I make sure that I have a local oncologist who's able to check in, get labs, for example, and be able to communicate back and forth. I want to turn briefly, Dr. Nagasaka, to brain mets, because that's really important. Say the same patient we mentioned in the second line setting, so post-progression on platinum doublet, has new brain metastases. How are you treating that patient? Is one drug better than the other here, or do we not have sufficient data yet to say?
So unfortunately, I don't think we have sufficient data to say yet. And for that Because of that, I tend to currently rely on my radiation oncology colleagues to get them gamma knife or SRS, just because I'm not entirely convinced if these any of these drugs are reliably penetrant to the brain.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, we don't really have sufficient prospective data. We've actually seen lots of exciting data of novel EGFR exon 20 specific TKI. We just saw data from BLU-451 presented at ASCO 2023. And I think the real interesting thing about this agent is that it potentially preclinically and maybe even clinically has some CNS penetration and CNS activity. I think this could be a potential option in the future for potential combination with other agents. Curious, Dr. Nagasaka, the sunvozertinib data, which we saw as well, you know, updated data presented at ASCO. Tell us a little bit about how that agent may fit into this space as well.
We saw the results from the updated Wukong-6 study at ASCO 2023, and included were 104 patients who were treated, and 97 patients were included in the efficacy analysis. And of them, 32% of them have baseline brain metastasis. So that's kind of like your average percentage of patients with brain mets. And at the data cutoff, the BERC-assessed confirmed objective response rate was an impressive 60.8%. So that number, anything north of 50% gets me really excited in this field. So I thought was very exciting. And even in those patients who had baseline brain metastasis, the confirmed objective response rate was at 48.5%. So that was promising. The other note that I would make was that the majority of treatment emergent AEs were grade 1 or 2. And that was also nice to see as well.
I agree. I mean, an exciting agent. But now that we have two FDA-approved agents and multiple agents coming down the pike, how do you think the landscape will change over the next 2 to 3 years for this patient population?
Sure, I think that's a great question. So I think there's multiple things that needs to be considered. So doing better with efficacy. So maybe bringing these agents to earlier lines, as Dr. Sabari mentioned, for the Papillon study that is combining chemotherapy with amivantamab in the first line space, and it's being compared to chemotherapy. So that kind of design is really exciting to me. So like you have a drug, how can we make it even better? How can we prevent resistance? So maybe bringing them into earlier lines of therapy, that is one approach. I think we already talked about this, but we need drugs that penetrate the CNS better. So that's another thing. But also, I think, you know, if you think about it, I just click on Epic and order the drug. It is up to the patient who comes like weekly for the first 5 weeks, or they might be taking the pills daily. It is up to the patients to endure all of the toxicities that are related to these treatments. So how can we better manage the toxicities is also another real area I think we need to do better at.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And, you know, just like you mentioned for amivantamab potentially moving to the front line, mobocertinib is also being studied on the EXCLAIM-2 trial, and that's mobocertinib versus chemotherapy in the front line, slightly different design than amivantamab, and we hope to see that data as well shortly. You know, it's an interesting time, and you know, as we sort of conclude, you know, none of these therapies cure disease, and I think that's an important point. You know, acquired resistance is inevitable, so I think better understanding the acquired resistance mechanisms here, and I think we're starting to see that MET-mediated, you know, MET amplification, for example, may play a role, particularly in mobocertinib and other the small molecules, tyrosine kinase inhibitors that we, you know, sort of discussed. But thinking about how we can sequence these agents is going to be critical. And I agree with your comment, Dr. Nagasaka, toxicity is important. If we have an agent that is toxic up front, it's going to be difficult to combine these moving forward. So this has been an extremely informative discussion. Thank you, Dr. Nagasaka, for a great, great discussion on this rare population, but I think an important population.
Don't forget to subscribe to the Oncology On The Go podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere podcasts are available, or listen online at cancernetwork.com/resources/podcasts. The Oncology On The Go podcast is the official podcast of cancernetwork.com. the home of the journal Oncology. For more information, visit us at cancernetwork.com and find us on Twitter at cancernetwork without the O, or on Facebook and LinkedIn at cancer-network.